Using such herbicides on Gaza Strip by the Israelis, it's kind of offensive towards the Palestinian farmers. At the same time, towards the Palestinian food security. These areas are feeding the Palestinians with the needed vegetables and other kinds.
Rights groups say the suffering of farmers and their families in Gaza reflects the scope of Israeli human rights violations.
Gazan farmers have been hit hard by the Israeli blockade and wars since 2007. Now experts say that Israel's poisoning of crops will make a bad situation worse and harm vital sources of food in the territory. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
As the world's eyes are on the Russia-Ukraine conflict, the Saudi led war in Yemen is still taking the lives of more civilians and pushing the country to the brink of famine. A recent UN report says 17.4 million Yemenis are food insecure, and the number is likely to go up to 19 million by the end of the year.
Unfortunately, the United Nations reports did not clarify the main reason for the deterioration of the humanitarian situation in Yemen, which is the blockade imposed by Saudi Arabia and its allies. The only solution to end the humanitarian crisis is to lift the siege and allow Yemenis to import food and medicine.
Back in 2015, Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a deadly war in Yemen to bring back to power former President Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi. Hundreds of thousands of people, including women and the children, have lost their lives since then.
I was sitting in my house with my children in the evening, and suddenly a missile struck the next house. The explosion destroyed my house as well. We were so afraid.
Saudi warplanes targeted our neighborhood. Look at the destruction. This is a crime, and unfortunately, the world's watching in silence.
The Saudi war has impacted all aspects of civilian lives in Yemen, including the healthcare system, which is on the verge of collapse. This comes amid the ongoing fuel shortage, as Saudi Arabia keeps detaining Yemeni oil ships, despite the fact that the vessels have UN permits.
We suffer from a severe lack of fuel. We cannot operate medical devices without electricity, not to mention the lack of medicines and medical solutions. There is overcrowding in the medical centers. Unfortunately, the United Nations did not provide us with anything other than media statements. The international community must stop Saudi Arabia from seizing Yemeni oil ships.
Children are the most affected people by Saudi Arabia's war. The rate of child malnutrition is one of the highest in the world, and the situation continues to deteriorate.
More than a million children are suffering from malnutrition in Yemen, and I believe the number is greater than this. And we are coming to a worse period because we do not have the most basic needs necessary to save the lives of sick children, such as milk, solutions, and medicines.
Observers say the years-long Saudi war in Yemen has only created the world's worst man-made humanitarian crisis. They say years of failure should be enough for Riyadh to start looking for other means to get rid of the quagmire it stuck with its war in Yemen. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
On Thursday, Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian arrived in Beirut to hold talks with Lebanese officials. Abdollahian expressed his country's willingness to provide aid to Lebanon in different fields, especially in the economic and commercial sectors.
Almost a month ago, I met with Lebanese Prime Minister Najib Mirati in the Munich summit, and I informed him about the Islamic Republic of Iran's readiness to assist Lebanon in building two power plants, where each would provide 1,000 megawatts of electricity. This is in addition to Tehran's readiness to cooperate with Lebanon in economic development and other fields.
Abdollahian met with top Lebanese officials to discuss bilateral ties as well as latest developments in the region. President Michel Aoun stressed during his meeting with the Iranian minister that any progress in the Vienna talks as well as negotiations between Iran and Saudi Arabia will have positive impact on the region and the world. During his talks with Lebanese Parliament Speaker Nabih Berri and Prime Minister Miqati, Abdollahian touched upon the significance of the upcoming parliamentary elections in Lebanon. As Lebanon is dealing with economic crisis, some experts believe U.S. bans on any dealing with other Asian states, especially Iran, has exacerbated Lebanon's problems.
the U.S. pressure and the Western country against the Iranian commitment to help Lebanese people in supporting their living, of daily living. This is what prevents the Lebanese government from receiving the funds and the support of the Iranian people and Iranian government. As people and as local authorities in Ghubayri, we welcome for any support coming from the Iranian people, first of all, and the Iranian government for the sake of better survival.
Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah also held a meeting with the Iranian minister where they discussed developments in Lebanon and the region. Abdullahian met with Palestinian factions and reiterated Iran's support for the full liberation of Palestine. The Iranian foreign minister has reiterated the Islamic Republic of Iran's previous calls to build two electricity stations, which could substantially resolve Lebanon's energy crisis. However, Lebanese officials seem reluctant to face U.S. intimidations and work with Iran, or even China for that matter, to change Lebanon's dire conditions. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Due to the conflict in Ukraine and Western sanctions against Russia, it has never been more costly to buy essential food items in the European Union, and the situation is set to get much worse. The world's biggest wheat producer is Russia. The third largest is Ukraine.
Wheat is a very good example. When I say wheat, we are actually talking about bread to feed people.
In fact, wheat prices have risen by 70%. The European Commission has just unveiled plans to support food producers and reduce tax to 0% on certain food items. €330 million has been announced to support Ukrainian farmers.
They need, for the spring sowing campaign, they need 50,000 tons of fuel per week.
Animal feedstocks are on the decline. Campaigners say millions could starve in East Africa if EU leaders don't do more to help poorer nations. Syria and Yemen have also been singled out for needing special support.
There are in fact 14 low-income countries which depend for more than 50% of their wheat imports on these two countries, on Ukraine and Russia.
The European Commission has presented new legislation to make it mandatory for member states to ensure 80% gas reserves are put in place before November. Experts say that is wishful thinking. 3.5 million Ukrainian refugees have now arrived in the EU. Most countries in the bloc have failed to take in their fair share, but some already have.
Poland is in top. The country number two is Austria. The country number three is Cyprus. Country number four is Czech Republic.
Almost €3.5 billion has been set aside from the EU budget to support refugees, including 1,470 unaccompanied children who have arrived in the bloc from Ukraine. Some nations are saying it's simply not enough money. EU leaders will hold a summit here on Thursday and Friday to consider, amongst other things, a request from Poland for new funding towards the cost of dealing with the growing refugee crisis. All indications so far suggest that request will be rejected. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Over the past week in France, social unrest has been a near daily occurrence, but it may be an everyday issue now and until after the presidential election. Public transport unions in Paris have called an unlimited strike starting March 25th over rampant inflation. Reduced purchasing power was the number one election issue in 2017 and 2012, but the unrest in Ukraine and the European Union's response to it has sent costs haywire. The increases arrive after a decade of right-wing austerity measures, which suppressed wages, reduced social services, and decreased job stability, leaving the average person especially vulnerable to record-high prices. Across the nation, unions were already protesting in an immediate response to President Emmanuel Macron's promise to raise the retirement age to 65. It's a bold gambit, given how unpopular such a change would be. But Macron appears to be betting that polls are correct and that he'll win re-election.
Plenty of people die before the age of 65. Can they never retire? Plenty of workers have physically demanding jobs and are poorly paid. Should they live in poverty and work until their death as well? 65 is way too late. and it's another step too far by Macron.
Austerity, then the coronavirus, now the Ukraine-related instability. Many say France is on the brink of a return to yellow vest levels of unrest if more far-right economic policies are demanded of the average person, but not of the rich.
Raising the retirement age is a certain way to reduce the number of available jobs. So from an economic point of view, not only would this not solve our unemployment problems, but it will actually be counterproductive. Macron is doing things from a purely ideological perspective and not at all with a view of helping the people of France.
France's presidential election has been dominated by disinterest. Voters have tuned out a campaign which was based on Islamophobia and xenophobia, and then the unrest in faraway Ukraine. Many wonder if Macron's call to raise the retirement age may have awoken a sleeping giant, the French public. France seems to be ignoring or has forgotten about the presidential election, but regular protests are reminding the country of the long-running domestic issues which France still faces. Some of the answers may be fought out in the streets over the next month. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
A delegation from the International Academic Campaign Against Occupation and Apartheid headed to the offices of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, OHCHR, as well as the UN Special Coordinator's Office, UNSCO, in Gaza. They handed the memorandum on Israeli apartheid signed by around 70 international organizations, human rights networks, academics, and researchers from 45 countries. The campaign is calling on the United Nations and Western countries to impose sanctions on the Israeli regime for its occupation of the Palestinian territories and its apartheid regime. The Israeli regime is an occupying power and has kept the Gaza Strip under a crippling blockade since 2007 and also waged four wars on the tiny enclave.
We are here to condemn Israeli apartheid, and we call on the international community to support the Palestinian people. We also demand and end Israeli crimes. Israeli leaders must face justice for their crimes against the Palestinian people.
Tel Aviv also practices apartheid policies against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. Among Israel's apartheid policies is the demolition of Palestinian homes in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. Israel also keeps thousands of Palestinian prisoners in its jails under inhumane detention conditions. Israeli forces also use excessive force to kill and maim peaceful Palestinian protesters in the blockaded Gaza Strip as well as in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds.
Today we are here to prove that the crimes of the occupations against the Palestinians and the prisoners must be documented and to support the Palestinians to obtain their rights.
Last month, at least 277 human rights groups and civil society organizations around the world denounced Israeli officials for imposing apartheid on Palestinians.
Observers say that Israel's apartheid against Palestinians is a cruel system of domination that constitutes a crime against humanity. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging. And to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it. And leave no grief unless Thou takes it away. And leave no enemy. And leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of In the name of Allah, the best of the names. In the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is His anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is His good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from Thee, O Patron of Beneficence.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to another edition of The Spotlight. Now, the gathering of top diplomats from Israel, Egypt, the UAE, Bahrain, and Morocco, as well as the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken in Palestinian-occupied territories referred to as the Naqab Desert, has provoked strong reactions from Palestinian resistance groups, calling it a symbol of cooperation with Israeli plots and occupation. In this edition, we will be discussing what is behind this move and what it means for Palestinians fighting for their freedom. My guests for tonight's show are Palestinian Solidarity Campaign Mick Napier from Edinburgh and human rights advocate and Palestinian activist Amal Wahdan from Ramallah.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Thank you very much to both of you. Let's begin with Mr. Napier. Now, this meeting is being held in the occupied territory of the Naqab Desert. Isn't this another stab in the back of the Palestinians?
It's not secret anymore. It's not furtive anymore. The Saudi regime is still keeping in the shadows its deepening alliance with Israel, but this is now out in the open, and it's clear that these regimes have decided that there's nothing that Israel will do which will cause them to end their diplomatic relations, their normalization. It is absolutely incredible that a regime led by Naftali Bennett, who will be one of the hosts for the event, a man who said famously, "I've killed many Arabs and I don't have a problem with that," is now hosting the leaders, the foreign ministers of three of the Arab states in the region. And it's also interesting, by the way, that they're meeting Ben-Gurion's old ranch, I forget what it's called, something Sofa, because Ben-Gurion was very clear that there were no limits to Israeli expansion. He very clearly stated in a biography by an Israeli politician of him that there was no limits to be placed on Israeli expansion except that which could be achieved by military power. So these foreign ministers are meeting to really give a green light to Israel to commit increasing crimes against the Palestinian people, and also, I think, to cause Israel to become stronger, which ultimately will be a threat to not just the Palestinians, for whom it's a deadly threat, but for the whole region.
Exactly, Mr. Napier. That's absolutely correct. And Ms. Wahdan, as Mr. Napier mentioned, the presence of politicians of this caliber will obviously embolden Israel and encourage more atrocities against Palestinians. What is the motive of these Arab leaders who were once considered supporters of their Palestinian brothers and sisters, and how far do you think they would go?
I think this shows that these Arab regimes have reached a bankruptcy, a political bankruptcy, total political bankruptcy. This summit of shame, as we call it, is not going to bring any security for the colonial apartheid Israeli regime. It's not going to bring anything for the Gulf states as well, for the Egyptians and for the Moroccan together. The people of these countries actually are anti-colonialization, anti-normalization with the colonial apartheid Israeli regime. So they couldn't achieve anything after they publicly started normalizing with apartheid Israel. So it seems like Israel is going to be gaining some moral, let's say, achievements. On the ground, there was a big demonstration in the Naqab area on the Land Day. That's the 46th anniversary of Land Day in Palestine, which is going to be celebrated on the 30th of March. It is coinciding with a military operation that was run or executed by a Palestinian from Beersheba, which is Beer Saba in the Naqab. So all these the resistance and the confrontations by the Palestinians is accelerating as well to defy and to confront the Israeli acceleration of of their aggressions against the Palestinians in all of Palestine. The Nakba is in 1948. The people of the Palestinians there have been facing land confiscations since 1950. And the Israelis continue to expropriate more lands from the Palestinians, continue to destroy villages for the Bedouins there, like Al-Arqub, for example. It was destroyed over 200 times, and it was rebuilt again by the Palestinians. So all these measures, harsh measures, aggressive measures against the Palestinians will create resistance, will create confrontation. And this confrontation has been accelerating in the Nakba area in particular, as in all Palestine, but particularly Nakba area, and the Palestinians there has been confronting all these measures day after day. So what we are seeing is all of Palestine is going to be confronting the Israelis on land day and afterwards during Ramadan month. So all these accelerating, as Israel has been saying just a while ago, the Israeli army is being put on alert because they are expecting some sort of missile attack against the summit, the shame of the summit of shame in the Nakba area, which means that Palestinians in total are refusing this summit to be taken place on their occupied land, and continue to staff Palestinians since actually the establishment of these monarchies as a functional states in the few decades after the oil. So the United Arab Emirates has been established in 1972. Our connection with the land in Palestine goes back to 10,000 years, and the United Arab Emirates have been established 1972 by the will of the British colonization in the Gulf and in our area. So there is no doubt for us that these countries are going to face, even in their countries, they're going to face confrontation, and they're going to lose the game with the Israelis. The Israelis here to gain more money from the Gulf states, while are going to lose.
I'm sorry, our time is limited, so let's go over the questions faster. Mr. Napier, I would like to ask you this question. The normalization with Israel, what does it mean for the Palestinians who are fighting for freedom, and what options are they left with to realize their goal of liberating their occupied lands?
I think they realize who their friends are and who their enemies are. Look, I think this takes place against a background of a crisis inside Washington. Washington is interested above everything else in confronting China. That's the big foe, and everything else that detracts from that is a problem. America is drawing down its attention, its investments, military and economic and political, in the Middle East. And therefore the question for the Gulf Emirates like the UAE and Saudi Arabia and Bahrain and so on is, who will protect them from their own people? Who will protect them from external enemies? And they have decided that the best substitute for American intense interest in the area is Israel. So they're gravitating towards it because they correctly see Israel as an extension of American power into the region. I don't mean that Zionism is completely loyal to America. Far from it. You know, Zionism is for hire. It's not for sale. But it has been for hire to the Americans for a very long time, and that link remains strong. And therefore, if the states that were previously or up till now have been guaranteed with defense agreements with the USA are to look towards the future, they see that future as moving closer to Israel. Now, of course, there's lots of dirty poker. Morocco is going to be there because in order for Morocco to rubber stamp the dispossession of the Palestinians to give a green light to Israel, Israel and America gave a green light to Morocco to suppress the United Nations endorsed right of the people of Western Sahara to self-determination. This Sudanese government won't be there, but they've also signed a normalization deal with Israel. But that's a problem because there is a very powerful popular movement in Sudan which has prevented the Sudanese government from opening an embassy there so far. So for the Palestinians, they understand deeply and profoundly there's no alternative but resistance. Resistance in all its forms. Because actually the Israelis do not, at the end of the day, offer anything to the Palestinians except doom. Their expulsion, their replacement by Jews from around the world, or if not enough Jews, from anybody else as long as they're not Palestinians. And therefore they have to resist. And when they resist, they will find that the peoples of these states, the Egyptian people, the Moroccan people, are their allies, but the Moroccan and the Egyptian governments are, of course, their bitter enemies, tied very closely to America. And they're moving. The summit in the Negev, where if they look out of the window of their very exclusive hotel, as your other guest said, they will be able to see and smell and feel the rage, the ethnic cleansing which is taking place in the Nakab, a clear plan by the Israelis to remove the Palestinian Bedouin, many of whom have been involved in agriculture for a very long time. I mean, do your viewers know that in the Nakab, the Palestinian agriculturalists have faced aircraft, Israeli government aircraft, spraying poison from aircraft onto their crops, and the plan is to drive these people into concentration zones, terrible, poor, miserable, in order to free up most of the land surface for Jewish colonization. That's what these foreign ministers will be in the middle of until Monday, I believe. So the Palestinians have no alternative but to resist. Resist means possible, and they need the support of the masses of people in the Middle East and the masses of people around the world, like the California dockers who refuse to unload Israeli ships. If that spreads, Israel can be defeated ultimately.
Thank you very much. Now, Ms. Watton, do you think that there are any prospects of this summit leading to some kind of conclusion that may affect the political equations of the region?
Well, I think, first of all, the Israelis will not get anything out of this summit. The Israelis are facing existential threat in Palestine as well as in the region. The axis of resistance and the Palestinian resistance from one side are combined together to confront the Israeli expansionist policy. And the Israelis feel that this threat is getting closer and closer, and they're losing their battle with the Palestinians as well with the Arab nations around us and in the axis of resistance countries. So they have no future here except two choices, to leave the country here or to live as citizens without, you know, abolishing colonization, abolishing apartheid. This is the only choice that they have. But I think that the leaders of this apartheid regime is pushing even their own people to a confrontation, to a deadly confrontation with the Palestinians. And eventually, as we witnessed last May, during the sword operation, that the population, their population, the Jewish population, were afraid to stay in their homes. And the people of Lod, for example, in 1948, were trying to escape their city and go to other safer places. So what we are seeing very gradual and steadily, that the Israelis are retreating, although they are disclosing their plans to connect the West Bank to the, to what they call Israel, but on the ground they're facing more and more resistance from the people. An hour ago, as it was aired just minutes ago, there was an operation south of Haifa in 1948 where four policemen were shot by Palestinians. And four of them are having serious wounds. So what we are seeing on the ground in the West Bank, in Gaza, and in Jerusalem, include also in 1948, more and more resistance to the Israeli measurements, harsh measurements and aggressive measurements against the Palestinians. They think that they can suppress 7 million people in historic Palestine, and all what they see is more and more resistance, more and more confrontations. So what I see in the near future that the Palestinians will win this war and the Israelis will retreat. We'll win this war against the apartheid Israel.
Well, thanks, Ms. Watan. Mr. Napier, the summit has been called at a time when the parties to the JCPOA are very close to reviving the deal. Do you think this summit can in any way jeopardize that?
You know, it's almost impossible to call. It looks like they can't. It looks like Blinken is going there to tell his client states, the Arab foreign ministers, that this deal will go forward. And he's using all sorts of forms of words, threats against Iran, in order to tell them that there's no alternative but the acceptance of the JCPOA. So I'm not an expert in that field, but everything seems to point in that direction. And if I could just add a few things. These Arab foreign ministers are meeting there with Blinken, with the Israeli government leaders, who are gloating at this. The very fact of this meeting is a stick for them to beat the Palestinians with, to say to the Palestinians, look, we have relations with these governments. You are alone. You're isolated. You ultimately will face defeat. But as our other guest has said, that's not the case. The people who win in an anti-colonial struggle like this are not those who have massive violence and massive technology and an overwhelming military edge. That was the case in Algeria. The French won the military confrontation in Algeria. It was popular revolt which drove them out. And I think this will be the case again. In case after case, it's not the people with the great violence, that's the Israelis who win, hands down. It's the people who can accept the suffering, the pain, the agony that the Palestinians are going through and still continue to resist. And these foreign ministers cannot give Israel the legitimacy which it craves. It craves legitimacy. It's born in blood and ethnic cleansing, and it craves acceptance by the world. But the only people who can give Israel legitimacy are the Palestinians, and they will not do so. Our other guest has shown eloquently that resistance is rising. If you look back at last May, when there were moves against Al-Aqsa Mosque, fascist gangs in Israel were attacking Palestinians, rockets from Gaza challenged the Israelis in a way that they never expected, and it created a degree of unity among the Palestinian people I hadn't seen for a very long time. So, yes, I agree with your other guest. Israel can be defeated. It depends on Palestinian resistance and other actors in the region and beyond coming to their aid.
Mr. Napier, that was a great example, Algeria right there. You pointed that out. And Ms. Watan, the Abraham Accords are a rare Trump-era policy that was fully embraced by Biden's team. What does this mean for the Palestinian resistance group? And we have only 1 minute left.
Yeah, well, the U.S. administration's policy towards Palestinians and in other areas of the world, it hasn't changed. With Biden, with Trump, with Bush, with Obama, it's the same policy. You know, who runs the USA foreign policy? is the industrial complex, is the financial companies, and it's not the people who elect, it's not the parties, it's not the Democrats or the Republicans, it's not the people who elect their representative to make these foreign policy. There is the deep state which puts forward this foreign policy. And it doesn't change whether it's Abraham agreement was signed during Trump. Biden has blessed it and went forward with it. The USA embassy in Jerusalem is there to stay. The Biden administration didn't move it back to Tel Aviv. So their policy is just the same. Who decides is mainly the military complex in the USA. And we're going to see the same treatment by the USA. Blinken is here to order Palestinian Authority to go ahead with their policies here. As I said before, the people on the ground, the people who are confronting the Israeli occupation,
I'm sorry, we're running out of time. So I saw Mr. Napier also nodding, agreeing with Ms. Amal Wahdan, a human rights advocate and Palestinian activist who joined us from Ramallah, and, of course, from the Scottish-Palestinian Solidarity Campaign, Mick Napier out of Edinburgh. Thanks to both of you for sharing your thoughts on this edition of The Spotlight. And thanks for following us.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. The very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Close up, Iran.
Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler,
to know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. I am now at Mehrabad Airport of Tehran. You may want to know where I'm going to take a tour today. Actually, today we are heading to Yazd, and our final destination is Fahraj village. In this village, we will visit the oldest mosque of Iran, the Jame Mosque of Fahraj. Fahraj village is located 22 kilometers southeast of the city of Yazd. This village dates back to pre-Islamic era. This village was once called Farofar. The Jame Mosque of Fahraj, or the Congregational Mosque of Fahraj, is the oldest mosque in Iran and is one of the oldest mosques in the world. This mosque was built in the first half of the first Hijri century. The main building of the Jame Mosque of Fahraj dates back to the Sasanid era, which changed into a mosque after the emergence of Islam in Iran. The Jame Mosque of Fahraj is the type of Shabestani and does not have any Iwan, that is, rectangular hall or space, usually vaulted, walled on three sides, with one end entirely open. This mosque has kept its usage and is still used for performing daily prayers. What is interesting about the mosque's architecture is its simplicity. You won't see any extra design and decoration. Inside the mosque, there is no mihrab, dome, inscriptions, tile work, or other crafts usually used in building a mosque. The Jame Mosque of Fahraj primarily consists of an internal courtyard, main Shabistan, winter Shabistan, the entrances, and the minaret. I am now in the beautiful village of Fahraj. This village has an old part that houses the Jame Mosque of Fahraj. The alleys of this village are very pretty. The alley which I'm passing through right now has a ceiling. Since this region is very hot and dry, the alleys are covered to protect the passersby against the scorching sun. Well, we are getting close to the Jame Mosque of Fahraj. I can see its minarets. I have brought a chador with myself, which I'm going to wear. Since this mosque is still used for worshipping, we should observe the etiquettes and manners of attending a mosque. Thank you.
I am now in the central courtyard of Fahraj Mosque. Honestly, this structure is a very simple and plain building. No tile work, no decorations. Though, the modest architecture has a very strange effect on one's spirit. The combination of lofty art and spirituality, you know. You will be amazed at how this plain building can arouse a mysterious feeling in you. I'm totally affected by it. Words fail me in describing the beauty of this mosque. Adobe bricks in big size and barrel vaults are all the type of architecture which belongs to the Sasanid era. Before I forget, this mosque has two mihrabs. There is also a minaret next to the mosque, which has been added to the mosque later. There is also a winter Shabistan, which archaeologists believe has been added to the mosque later. The atmosphere of the mosque is very spiritual and gives one a very good sense of spirituality. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.